Could you build a business that's better for our planet? That's what I have set out to answer. Hi, I'm Marco Pimentel, marketing expert and entrepreneur and host of the podcast, Someone Like You. I become fascinated in finding creative climate solutions in business, and on the podcast, I break down how founders and CEOs are building climate-friendly business solutions that are opportunities for growth while being better for the planet.
If you go to a big oil company or go to an environmental NGO or anyone in between, they all have part of the equation and they all have part of the solution. And so, you know, the grand goal behind all this is how do we have the 8+ and more billion people over time on the planet provided for in sort of in the sense of material prosperity.
Global energy-related CO2 emissions surged to a record high in 2022, marking a concerning milestone in our collective carbon footprint. Today, I speak with Robert Murphy. He's the CEO of Othersphere, about the pressing need to accelerate sustainable infrastructure deployment amid these increasing emissions. Robert's extensive background from global organizations like the World Bank to tech startups such as Acclima has positioned him as a visionary leader in the field. He delves into Othersphere's mission, a spatial computation platform revolutionizing the identification of optimal sites for zero to low greenhouse gas infrastructure with an initial focus on the pivotal role of hydrogen. Robert shares how Othersphere's spatial economics platform empowers project developers, operators, and financiers to expedite the deployment of more environmentally beneficial projects, streamlining team efforts, origination, and diligence while enhancing stakeholder alignment. We explore the innovative strides Othersphere is making to reshape our approach to a sustainable infrastructure, mitigating carbon impact and propelling the world towards a more eco-friendly future. Here is our conversation. I wanted to take a second to tell you about our Season 2 sponsor, Digital Scope. Did you know your website has a carbon footprint? Well, digital technology has a larger carbon footprint than the entire aviation industry, and it's only getting bigger. Digital power consumption is increasing by 9% every year. At this rate, our digital carbon footprint could be responsible for as much as 14% of global emissions by 2040. If you're a digital-first company, or really any company with a website, and want to understand the impact your website is having on the environment, Digital Scope can translate visitor data into carbon measurement, all with a simple one line of code added to your website. Check out digitalscope.com/someone like you. The first 100 people to sign up get free access for an entire year. Robert, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much for having me.
I'm excited to talk to you today. You have obviously a quite immense background in energy and understanding energy, and obviously this is a massive topic of discussion as of late, as it should be. But before we get into Othersphere and what you've been working on and building, I wanted to just ask about your correlation to climate and sustainability and where you felt like this was an area that you needed to focus in and what background brought you here.
Yeah, happy to. I mean, my short answer is I came by this honestly. I was born in Calgary. My father worked in oil and gas. So I grew up around the energy sector. When we were 10, we moved to the Middle East. Then I spent a number of years in Yemen and then sort of bouncing around in different countries as sort of an oil kid. So I grew up around oil and gas and saw all the pros and cons, basically all the talking points about sort of energy and driving prosperity, I believe are like absolutely true. But then the flip side being sort of working and living in countries where you see some of the downsides, and even that includes here. And so I think I just always probably was going to work in energy because from a very early age, sort of developed a fascination with it. And then so I went to school for business and then went to the sort of grad school for international relations again, just planning to go into the sector in one way, shape, or form, never believing that it's sort of one thing or another. It's not about sort of the pure technical side, nor is it pure commercial, nor is it pure policy. It's just a fascinating sector that really overlaps with all of them. And then, yeah, my career just sort of unfolded from there.
And so first kind of roll into energy industry, what did you get into and where did you go?
I started at an oil and gas consulting focus firm in Washington, D.C. And so I was looking mostly at national oil companies. So these are the large oil and gas producing countries who this was nearly 20 years ago. These companies were they had been for a long time almost sort of government shells, and they were the international oil companies would go in and they would partner with these local national oil companies, but do a lot of the work. And then in many years in between, a lot of them had really sort of progressed, and now they were as, or even sometimes higher functioning than the international oil companies. And so these NOCs were of more and more interest in the market. So I started looking at those and really understanding how they functioned. And these are, you know, sort of the countries like, say, Saudi Arabia or Iran or Iraq, through to, say, Brazil or the Chinese national oil companies. And they all had different flavors of their home countries and things going on. And yeah, it was fascinating. And so that was sort of, it was, as going back to what I was saying before, it was such a nice split of the political, the commercial, the technical side of energy. That's, I think, why I started out there and then just moved on gradually evolving through the sector, working renewable energy consulting in a similar way, and then gradually getting on towards more of sort of an operational side and getting, you know, getting on the ground more often.
At what point did you start to think about this energy transition from oil and gas? And, you know, like you said, you're an oil kid that you got to see it firsthand and everything. So that, you know, gives you quite an experience. But at what point in your career did you start to think, okay, we likely have an energy transition and we need to be transitioning into more of a focused around renewables and looking at energy in a different way? And I guess at what point in your career did you decide that this is something that I want to start working in more slowly?
Mm-hmm. I think a lot of it was a new area. So working in oil and gas, seeing how the fundamentals of the energy sector work and realizing that that's going to be true for a long time, that oil and gas and both in the products they create are very competitive. And they, you know, and as I said, enable a lot of sort of prosperity. And so there's a lot of reasons why the world will continue consuming them. So that will be what it'll be. And that sector will evolve over time. And then as a sort of, this is again about 20 years ago. So renewables, like they were much earlier in their sort of growth in the deployment curves. Carbon markets and pricing were just starting to really come into being in a meaningful way. And it was exciting. It was an interesting new area to work on. And so knowing that the traditional energy sectors are essential and will kind of continue on, and they're sort of in more of a steady state sort of stewardship mode, whereas a lot of these new sort of approaches, and as you said, the energy transition writ large, was open territory, a lot of risk, a lot of uncertainty. And I think that's just an interesting space to try to work into. And so I've always sort of, I think, gravitated towards that through my career. So the oil and gas consulting, as I said, I moved over to renewable energy consulting for that reason, that I was just sort of interested in sort of these, the newer side of things and what was coming down the pipe. And then when I went back to DC, I went to the World Bank and worked in energy projects, so all in developing countries, so lower middle income countries. And it was a really interesting mix. And it was really an interesting time in the sense of renewables were still in earlier days, less reliable from a technology perspective, higher cost. And so the bank was trying to straddle the line between local prosperity and enabling countries to have energy access to sort of grow their economies versus global climate change. And it was more of a binary choice. And it was a little bit of an either or, whereas now I think the technologies have evolved such and the market understanding has evolved such that countries can make different choices. And it isn't quite as much as choosing between prosperity and sort of a, you know, whether it's thinking about climate change on a global scale or sort of local environmental effects, we're doing a better job at doing things that are, you know, truly, quote unquote, sustainable.
And I guess that led you into, you know, you've been working for quite large organizations. Why pivot to be an entrepreneur and decide that, you know, now is the time to get a bunch of funding and start others' fear? Like, how did you make that pivot and that decision?
I think it was a progression. So I loved working at the World Bank. The downside for me was, again, that especially around climate, it was a very political process and challenge. And again, this is about 10, 15 years ago. So it has evolved. So I thought to myself, okay, I want to go back to the private sector. I think there's a clear set of goals there. And, you know, what those goals are expanding. So it's becoming less about just pure profit and more about sort of building a longer term business that's sort of more holistically taking into account environmental factors and workforce factors and so on. So went back to the private sector, spent a couple of years at Enbridge in Calgary in their international project development group. So looking at pipelines, looking at renewable energy projects. And I think I enjoyed being back in the private sector side. And then I've sort of missed, I think, the the global scale of things I was working on in DC. And so I had an offer to go back down to the States to Chevron. And so went and spent about 5 years at Chevron in a few different roles. And I think that solidified for me the sort of power of doing things on the market side, the building and building things that make sense from a dollars and cents perspective is how we ultimately sort of change systems over the long term. And then, yeah, and then my first step into sort of the early stage tech world was Acclima, an air quality mapping and monitoring startup. And I was there for about 5 years as a head of strategy and BD, wore all the early stage hats in terms of building products and thinking about data and commercial models and fundraising and just the whole nine yards. And I loved it. I think it was exhausting, but in a fun way. And I think that's where gradually going from sort of World Bank through to private sector, thinking about private sector for me is at least the path and the channel I would like to sort of drive some positive change. Going to Acclima and realizing the early stage environment in particular is where you can really be creative and have some fun with all this and try to hopefully build something new and impactful. So then I left Acclima in 2021 and moved over to Breakthrough Energy. And this is the Bill Gates funded climate fund and vehicle that has been pushing a really interesting avenues for a number of years around particularly hard to decarbonize sectors and bringing those technologies to market that they're hard to fund in traditional VC models. They're hard to get them out the door. They're hard to de-risk and bring into incumbent sectors. So I went into Breakthrough Energy as an advisor to their startups, knowing I wanted to stay in sort of the early stage world, but knowing I wanted to move back closer to energy from Acclima. And then OtherSphere happened somewhat organically through that process. A lot of the companies I was advising that are part of the Breakthrough portfolio, where to build was a key question. And so it's not just a function of having the technology, whether it's green steel, green hydrogen, green cement, perform effectively in a technical sense. It's about having it actually be competitive out in the real world. And where you build it has a massive impact on that. So Breakthrough talks about sort of the quote unquote green premium a lot. And this is the price difference between lower carbon commodities and incumbent. And that green premium is very location dependent. And so I started doing this work in a fairly ad hoc way, supporting some of the Breakthrough companies. And then we started talking about the potential for a broader market need. And that this is a question that developers of all walks of life, whether they be large companies or small companies, are facing in terms of how and where to build in an increasingly complex world. And fast forward a few months of conversations and sort of internal approvals, and the result was OtherSphere.
And so the initial work through Breakthrough and, you know, working on this kind of problem through a few different companies, maybe just understand who are your customers and kind of the, you know, what is their challenge and what are they kind of currently using that you decided that, that this really is a technology platform that needs to be able to build. And so who were your kind of earlier customers and how did you kind of think about this market and where you were going to kind of fit?
Yeah, we're starting with hydrogen as the first commodity we're focused on. And so we're looking very much at sort of the physical commodity side of things. The assumption being that there are tools available for, say, wind and solar siting, and there's room for improvement there. And maybe we wander into that world eventually, but the physical commodity side, so moving molecules rather than electrons, is a space where I think better tools and better data, can have a huge impact. And there's just a larger delta for us to hopefully help fill. And so we're starting with hydrogen, and then the actual user group we're most focused on initially is developers. So who are the companies actually trying to put steel on the ground and projects on the ground around the world? Because our thesis is they're sort of the tip of the spear. So these are sort of big companies who they may deploy some of their own technologies or also may buy technologies off the shelf from other producers. So hydrogen electrolyzers may be their own or they may be someone else's, on down to smaller companies that are developing their own technology and they're looking at building their first or second of sort of a kind of commercial scale plants. And all of those users and all of those sort of individuals doing that good work are working with Excel primarily. They may have some of the or like sort of geospatial tools to play with to sort of try to triangulate around the right location. But in the real, like what at least I found in my experience in the past at like Enbridge and Chevron, it's very relationship driven. It's very much, you know, the team knows a certain market. Okay, so we're familiar there. Let's go there. We know a certain company. Okay, how can we work with them? And so because the world is so complicated, the data is fairly sparse, the analysis is tricky, you tend to just go with what you know, and that's very understandable. But what our thesis is, by indexing the globe and by trying to sort of drive a more systematic analysis of where you would build things, that everyone can perform better, the teams can perform better, the projects that result from those teams can be higher performing. And that ultimately that leads to accelerated decarbonization, because new technologies are proven to be bankable earlier, and then they get into the rinse and repeat more and more quickly. And so that's our thesis, starting with developers, focus on hydrogen initially, and then we'll broaden out over time, because by commodities, so going from hydrogen to, say, the ammonias or methanols or steels or cements of the world, but also by user group. Because in the end of the day, like, climate is, it's a large, at least in my view, is kind of a large alignment problem. You have so many different stakeholders that have to be kind of on the same page, that it's the right time to build that technology at that location. So the developers are the, as I said, the tip of that spear. They have to bring along the off-takers who will actually buy the commodity they're going to produce. They have to bring along the financiers who'll fund the project, the policymakers, either to sort of permit and approve the project or even provide incentives to sort of make it possible in the first place. Communities are like essential to bring into the process. And so it's getting things done quickly at the scale we need to is going to be incredibly hard, given how all those stakeholders tend to be misaligned and work in their own sort of world sometimes. And so the hope is, over time, we can bring a bit of, you know, bring some alignment into the market, build empathy across some of these user groups so they can kind of align around, okay, this is a objectively looks like a good idea to build. And so how can we do that together, as opposed to getting into misinformation and combativeness that I think we see with a lot of projects that are developed, even with the best intentions.
Every week on Someone Like You, we dive into stimulating conversations with founders, entrepreneurs, business owners, and the likes who are consciously and successfully creating sustainable business solutions for the long haul. Tune in every week for a new inspiring conversation on leading climate solutions. And if you're enjoying the podcast, don't forget, please subscribe on the platform of your choice and give us a rating and a review. Yeah, and I was actually listening to, and we chatted about this before the show, was Dr. Jonathan Foley from Drawdown, and he talked about, you know, time is really, really needed now because of the way that the carbon curve happens, and now is really, really, really important. And so it sounds like, to put it down into kind of a more of a simple term, is developers or big projects that are thinking about building hydrogen in specific locations, they're using kind of, you know, people and maybe some geospatial tools, or using Excel spreadsheets, but they're not taking kind of a bigger holistic approach across the whole project kind of thesis. And OtherSphere uses technology to bring in APIs and different tools and different kind of layers to say, like, this is a better optimal place to put this. And what's the, I guess, at the end of the day, is the benefit time? Is it cost? Is it, like, what are the benefits at the end of the day to the developer for using OtherSphere to find an optimal location?
Yeah, I think hopefully all of the above, but it starts with the teams themselves and the things that are easier to demonstrate in terms of value. So the hope is that by having this, the tool in the hands of these teams, and a lot of these development, like these project development teams, I mean, it's a little hyperbole, so they're sort of the unsung heroes of decarbonization, but there's a lot of sort of interest in inventing things in the lab and sort of the new hardwares and new technologies. But then scaling them gets into, it's a, the invention worked, but now it's kind of the muddier world of actually rolling it out, and slower, and it's a little less exciting, a little less sexy. But so these teams, I feel like they get less attention, they get less resource, but they're essential. And building a great development team is probably even more so than your technology, what will like make or break a development firm. So we want to empower those individuals on those development teams. And we start with sort of giving them data. So making just the data from the world available in their hands in an easy way. So that alone will save them a lot of time and effort trying to gather that in any given location they're looking at. Then doing the comparative analysis. So what we've done is we basically tiled out the world, breaking it up into a little under a square kilometer each. And on each of those tiles, we apply market and human and environmental values, and then run our models on top, in this case, starting with hydrogen. So we have a comparative view of how, at any given location, how, say, a certain form of hydrogen electrolysis would compare to, say, pyrolysis or steam methane reforming or any sort of other hydrogen production technologies. So we hand the developers the data, we hand them sort of the analysis, the comparative view, saying, well, how will this thing perform in terms of economics? What will its emissions look like? And will it be a good fit with local surroundings? And so hopefully that alone makes those individuals like work faster, more effectively, empowers them to do their best work. And then the hope is also then we're saving these firms on consulting fees, because a lot of this work is so complicated, it tends to be outsourced, and that can be fairly expensive for teams and firms. Or even just developing sort of the Excel spreadsheets and the models that they'll end up then taking to the financiers, and then having a long back and forth between the two in terms of aligning on, is this project a fundable thing or not? And so if we can put all the information and analysis in developers' hands, make them effectively, function more effectively, more quickly, save them a lot of costs on consultants, for example, and sort of bespoke work they have to get done, all of that hopefully then leads to better projects. And this is where we look back over time, and maybe we see lower cost of capital in the near term, or we can look back and say, improved IRRs in the longer term. But the goal is that these teams functioning more effectively lead to better projects, which then lead to sort of better performance for the corporate company and corporate entity itself. And then stepping up that one more level is then you just, that the market itself says, well, this technology is low enough risk, is scalable, and so more and more of the sort of more traditional financiers or developers come into the market, as opposed to it being, in some cases, in some of the sectors, dominated by early adopters or sort of specialist developers or specialist financial firms who are there to hopefully be, the initial conduits to bringing new technologies out. But then ultimately, how it really makes a big impact in terms of climate is that it's not novel, it's not sexy, it's traditional banks and traditional industrial companies that are building and developing these technologies.
And the business model, it sounds like it's a software as a service. Is that kind of the go-to-market right now, or is it a little bit different because of the way that you're integrating right now with companies? Because are you still in the beta phase right now of your product?
Yes, we are. Yeah. So we have a number of companies in our beta program now, and they're getting access to the tool sort of in a staged way and giving us just great feedback in terms of how we need to build it, both in terms of the usability of the tool itself, but also the data and the models underneath, because all of it has to come together. We're trying to, run a large scale global model, and making that functionally correct is half the battle, but then it's also making it actually accessible and understandable and usable to teams. And so all of that we're in the middle of now, and then aiming to actually sort of launch in a general release mode and fully publicly in Q1 next year. And so that's sort of where we are in terms of the development timeframe of all this. And it's a SaaS tool. We're fairly generic there. No surprises early on in terms of just a subscription model.
Subscription model, yeah. And so obviously quite complicated. A lot of layers, a lot of data. It sounds like, building a tool where, these and you're probably working with companies and people that have a lot of funds and the ability to put these things together. But obviously you put a team together with an idea together to bring a lot of data into a software product. People are going to be happy to pay for that as a SaaS tool versus doing that internally. How did you fund this? And I'm assuming this is a pretty decent sized team of developers to build out this tool.
Yeah, it is. We have a team of 10 today so far, and they're phenomenal. Basically, as you're alluding to there, the reason that I hope will succeed and ultimately be very impactful out there is that what we're doing is hard, but it is a thing that bigger companies could do in theory internally. But especially some of our bigger beta testers now, we've gotten a lot of comments that the team and I always love when they're just like, we've done in 6 months what they would do in, say, 3 years. And that's always nice to hear. Maybe it'd be great if the world didn't work that way, but it is what it is. So team of 10 now, phenomenal mix of software developers, data scientists, sort of energy experts, and doing our best to put something pretty exciting together. Funding wise, and when I went into the Breakthrough Fellowship, as I said, I went in as sort of advisor to their startups. And so the Breakthrough Fellowship is basically Breakthrough's pre-seed and seed stage funding vehicle. And then the next piece after that is Breakthrough Energy Ventures, which has sort of been around for longer. And that is sort of the more traditional VC fund that they've been 6 or 7 or 8 years out in the market now. And then there's also Breakthrough Catalyst, which is in the far end, which is much more focused on sort of project finance and concessionary project capital. But the fellowship, I went in as an advisor to their companies, and they were just phenomenally flexible. They're a great group. I was in the first year, so they were figuring it out as they went as well. It was a startup in its own right. And so the work I was doing with the teams caught their eye. I was really enjoying it. I think versions of other Sphere have been sort of, I've been pondering for years, but hadn't gone to breakthrough at all with the intent of building this or starting a company. Because in many ways, it's a terrible lifestyle choice. It's much better to just get a day job at a big company and keep life simple. But it seemed like it'd be an exciting thing to build, a necessary thing to build. And they agreed. And so we just started talking. It took a few months to sort of put together some proposals and do the internal work. So they gave us what is effectively our pre-seed funding from the fellowship, and that let us build. Let me put the initial team together at the beginning of this year. There was initially four of us, a mixture of full-time and part-time. We built our proof of concept out by May of this year. And then in May, June, we also closed our seed round in parallel. So that was led by Active Impact Investments based in Vancouver. And then that let us graduate from there. And so move on from sort of the proof of concept and cobbling it all together to building out the team of 10 who were all in place basically by the end of July. And we have been just building full tilt since then.
And the other side of the business, obviously you need to build a product and you're working, you know, in beta right now to feed that funnel of development. But the go-to-market strategy after, you know, a team of 10 people working with big projects and bigger companies, how do you build a go-to-market plan in this? Like this, it seems like a fairly daunting task. Is it all through, you know, business development? Is it through sales? Like how does that piece start to kind of come together, or at least have you thought about how that piece comes together?
Yeah, I mean, it comes together carefully is a really short answer and mildly glib one. The slightly longer answer is I think myself and some of the rest of the team, we have experience in big industrial companies or sort of in or big consulting firms that serve the big industrial companies. So we know what works, and we've also sat in the seats of our users, which I think is nice. So we have a sense of how we can provide value. We then have a sense of, I think, of how they could actually sort of use us and purchase us. And so we can actually go through a sales cycle with, you know, big companies or small companies alike. And so for us, we haven't said a lot yet. And so our other Sphere website right now is just very basic. And it's just most things we haven't had time to really put effort into it just yet. And also I think we've been focused on the building and really understanding from these testers who are already involved how we're valuable and really getting them to validate our thesis on the product, but also its potential impact. And so we haven't been in a rush to sort of really sort of flying our flag externally as yet. That'll change in the next couple of months. I think you're right though. It's a tricky challenge. I mean, frankly, we have it easy as a software company trying to work with industrials. It's a lot harder to work as a hardware company working with industrials. And so in many ways, we're hoping we can actually help bridge that divide so that early stage companies and even the bigger ones can work with the big incumbents because they're all having a better shared view of projects and how they can succeed together. And so we have it easier, but we still have to be sort of thoughtful about how we sort of put ourselves out in the world. Working in climate is complicated. There's a lot of, as I said, I think what we're trying to do in some ways is actually what like Project Drawdown has done, where they try to lay out what are the best, like the highest impact ways we can decarbonize that sort of make the most economic sense and try to go for those low hanging fruit first. We're doing the same thing from sort of a location perspective and saying, if we're going to decarbonize X or Y or Z commodity, where would be the best place in the world to build and just work your way up from there? So in theory, it's nice to go out and sort of just talk about sort of the dollars and cents or sort of the key metrics of a project. The reality is working in climate is complicated. There's a lot of politics that sort of that naturally spill into the sector and into these conversations. And so your go-to-market is complicated enough when you think about pricing and details and value and how to sort of cater to large and small companies. But then you step back and say, how does your branding reflect? You know, we have a big vision and a big goal for all of this, but we want to stay and sound reasonable and stay and sound humble as we go through this whole process. And so it's a really interesting space to navigate in, which is, stepping back from all of it, it's a little unfortunate because then if we do need to decarbonize quickly and it's just hard to work amid all these stakeholders and sectors, and it doesn't do us any favors collectively.
You took venture funding. And so when you do that, obviously you have to have some big goals and big plans. When you think about kind of the next 3 to 5 years, where do you see other Sphere and what are those kind of big goals and aspirations that you have that you want to build towards?
Our hope is that what the underlying technology we're developing, this indexing of the globe, it becomes quite self-reinforcing over time. And so we have more users who are testing and validating and improving this data. We bring in more commodities over time so that we, as a business, have sort of a broader reach in terms of impact and revenue, of course, as well. And they also reinforce each other, because started with hydrogen was deliberate because it sort of chains into a number of other commodity sectors. So hydrogen as a precursor to, say, ammonia or methanol or a lot of Power-to-X technologies. Hydrogen is on the road for most steel decarbonization pathways. And then it's adjacent to things like carbon capture and cement in different ways. And so we move forward by succeeding initially, just getting it right with one user group in one commodity sector, adding more commodities over time, and then adding, as I said, more user groups. So we bring in potentially developers, but also sort of catering to off-takers, financiers, potentially policymakers, all of those stakeholders that need to be aligned around what a project looks and feels like, and even potentially communities as well, because it's a very different animal in the sense of like how you lay out data and lay out a potential project in a way that is clear and understandable to the general public, as opposed to sort of an energy expert who's a commercial modeler. But they all have to be on the same page if the thing is a good idea. So expanding by commodity, expanding by user groups, and then in theory, we could add other sort of go beyond software into different business models over time. But all of that would still be predicated on that underlying indexing technology, and that being in some way a differentiator that lets us step into any new markets or any new opportunities in a way that is just better than what's available today.
As we wrap up, I think you said something that was interesting around entrepreneurship, that it was it's a terrible decision in terms of a lifestyle choice. And I hear you and I understand that. But, kind of a last question just around entrepreneurship. And I think, your journey to where you are today, and obviously your experience through energy and World Bank and renewables is amazingly long and an amazing experience to have all of that. But what would you say to people that are kind of sitting on that sideline, just about to jump in or wanting to jump into, to get into this climate space and build either tools or hardware or the hard things and software? What would you say to those entrepreneurs that are kind of sitting on that sideline thinking, maybe now is the time?
I mean, it is the time. That I think that's the easiest answer. That's the straightest forward piece of it for sure. It's just like, we have a big need and it's only just becoming clear, I think, to people, honestly, even though the conversation around climate has been going on for decades in various shapes and forms. I think it's really now just starting to kind of penetrate more and more in terms of day to day. Because ultimately, I think in my mind, it comes down to how people vote with their wallets or their ballots. And I think that's what's starting to shift. And then that will cascade back to demand for different choices all the way up. And so I think now is a great time to get into it. The need is pronounced. I mean, I think that sort of the El Nino cycle we're in right now is hopefully a little bit of an aberration in terms of sort of high temperature, almost globally, but certainly like breaking records in all kinds of different locations around the world. But it's a sign of what's to come. And so I think the need is there. The market is shifting. There's a lot of exciting technologies being worked on. And I guess my only thought, aside from just, start to anybody, is don't overthink it as well, that wherever you start will probably evolve. There's no silver bullet technologies. So you may move on between different technologies quite a bit throughout your career. And the other big thing is that no one has the right answer. So if you go to a big oil company or go to an environmental NGO or anyone in between, they all have part of the equation and they all have part of the solution. And so, the grand goal behind all this is, how do we have the 8+ and more billion people over time on the planet provided for in the sense of material prosperity? And there's a way to do that most efficiently. And there's a way where we kind of keep bumbling along as we do now, and the market's sort of driving a reasonably kind of optimal solution. And I think the answer is it has to be a collaborative effort. And so just start. Don't worry about the right technology or the right sort of type of organization in the beginning, because you'll probably end up moving around, and that'll probably be a great thing to see different perspectives on different technologies and different sort of worldviews. And that's how I think he gets closer to making, an impact and moving the needle in the long run.
Well, incredibly thoughtful, and thank you for joining us today.
Very happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, that's Robert Murphy from Othersphere. This podcast is co-produced with The Brand is Female. I hope you've enjoyed today's episode of Someone Like You. And if you did, please share this. We're a new podcast, and I would love it if you could share it with a family member, friend, colleague, work colleague, share it on Slack, whoever you do, just share and spread the message of these incredible brands. Please also support these type of companies. They're doing the hard thing, and the hard thing often takes a lot of people to get on board. And don't forget, please subscribe on the platform of your choice and give us a rating and review. I'm Marco Pimentel. Thank you for joining us today. For more information on Someone Like You, you can find us on Instagram at Someone Like You Podcast with all the links to the podcast, our website, and more information about the brands that we feature. Thank you again.